This is Storage Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
This is Chris Evans recording another Storage Unpacked podcast, and I'm here with Martin as usual. How are you doing today, Martin?
Yeah, not too bad. How are you doing, Chris?
Pretty good. Just getting ready for another trip to the US, Storage Field Day 19 tomorrow.
Have you packed?
No. I haven't even got my suitcase out of the loft.
Yeah, you don't have a suitcase, do you?
I just take a single bag and put some extra clothes on.
Yeah, you just wash your pants in the hotel sink, don't you?
Yeah. You've sussed me out. You've sussed me out. Mm. I actually turn them inside out first of all, and then wash them. There's no point washing them when you don't need to, after all, is there? Anyway, enough of that. Enough of any details about my past. We have a guest this week, thankfully, to divert us away from this sort of conversation. And funny enough, it's an old friend of mine, Dave Copey from MongoDB. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Martin. Great to be talking to you again, Chris. Nice to meet you, Martin. And thanks for the travel tips.
Absolutely. No problem. Free travel tips included. Obviously, I just said you work for MongoDB. Do you want to just give like a 30-second what you do for them?
Yeah, I work for the business value consulting team. We support the sales team when they're working with customers looking at moving to MongoDB and help them understand the ROI business case for choosing our solutions. So it's a very exciting role.
Great. So you obviously work for MongoDB, which is a database company. I'm hoping everybody who's listening to this understands that. But let me just qualify a little bit, and then that'll help to explain exactly what we're going to talk about today. So we've seen the rise of a number of different database types that step outside the normal norm of what we've been used to in terms of relational databases. And I would say they probably come in over the last 10 years or so, but we can debate that in a second. Now, document-oriented, if you remember, databases are one form of that, and they are slightly different to a standard relational database, which we'll get into. So the idea of today's conversation is to try and go through what we think a document-oriented database is and why it's different to a traditional database that we might be familiar with and why we would use that over and above what we've already been used to. Now, probably the best place to start is to say, what on earth do we mean by document database, and what is a document, Dave?
So that's a great question, and I think it's best to clear up a common misperception, which is when we say document, we're not talking about PDF or Word documents. You can think of a document as more akin to an object that an object-oriented programming language would use. So it's really, in MongoDB's case, a JSON document structure, like I said, akin to an object, as opposed to, you know, a Word document, something like that.
We'll come on to what JSON and other formats like XML and YAML mean, markup languages effectively mean, in a moment. But just going back to that document thing, an object, because we are a storage podcast, calling something an object could have a bit of a confusion with people who are used to an object store. We're not really talking about object in that sense. You're talking about object-oriented programming, which is something slightly different.
Correct.
Okay, do you want to explain what you mean specifically by object-oriented, just in case people are a bit confused by that?
Yeah, so most programming languages these days deal with objects when they're working with data. So, for instance, a customer is not just at one discrete field like a name. It's a collection of values, the person's name, date of birth, account number, you may have addresses, you may have phone numbers, account numbers, etc. So when a programmer works with those all of those data points together, they're considered an object, and you can do various operations on them. So when we talk about a document database, that customer object is considered a document, which is stored as is in the database.
Okay, I could think of it as a collection of metadata. Almost like
that would be a good way of describing it as well.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
I was going to say, but you just said it's not like an object we're used to. But when we start talking about metadata, it comes very close to what we're used to, Chris.
That is true. Yeah. That is, I guess, the reason why I thought it's good to talk about the metadata side, because in some respects, if you look at the way that metadata is connected to a traditional object, it's very much a key value type construct.
Yeah.
So you might say, you know, the format of the object is a particular type, or you might put a date on it or a time or an owner, and there'll be a field that says like owner, and there'll be a value to that field, which might be a username. correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, document databases are a form of key value stores in their own right, aren't they? They sort of fit into that classification.
I would say it a little differently. I think a key value database from our perspective is something like a Cassandra, and I think Redis falls into that category, where they actually persist the data on disk as a key with an associated value. So they're literally storing the data in that type of format. In a document database, you've got a lot more choices around the structure of the objects that you store. So it may just be a key that you use to retrieve the data and a value. But again, in the customer object scenario, there can be multiple fields, potentially dozens or even hundreds of fields that are stored within that object. And any one of them can be considered a key that can be used through an index to retrieve that object. So within the JSON format, each sort of lowest level JSON object can be considered a key value because it's a key for that particular field and a value for that field. But then the way a document is structured can be many of those types of objects.
You're saying that effectively that the way we group them together effectively makes it a document rather than just the fact that it's just a lot of single individual random key values.
Exactly, yeah. You get that flexibility of the rich structures and rich objects that you can store. And typically when you're talking about a non-relational database, there's a few categories that that are commonly used. Key value is one of them. Document is another. But things like graph databases, wide column stores, those are other categories of non-relational or NoSQL databases that you typically see referenced.
Okay, brilliant. So let's talk about how this looks when we compare it to a traditional database. So from my experience, I mean, you and I both have used IMS many, many years ago, which was, yeah, interesting. And I do remember we actually had so for anybody who's listening, Dave and I used to work together many, many years ago. And the system that we did our change management and problem management on actually was an underlying IMS database, I seem to remember.
Yes, I believe it was. You're right.
Yeah, I think it was.
That's right. Right.
But obviously, that was mainframe, and we've moved on a lot since then. A lot of databases now tend to be relational. So a relational database, we would expect things in columns and rows, and the record of each, or rather each record for an individual person is, or, you know, account or whatever it is we're storing, tends to be pretty much consistent and the same all the time. That's quite different from the way a document database works, isn't it?
Yes, it is, absolutely. So the relational format, and IMS as a hierarchical database, actually predates relational databases. And the reason relational databases, I think, became essentially the de facto database for decades is because they provided a really good way of storing data that could be consumed for any type of use case. And the way you store the data in a relational database, which, as you said, is rows and columns, very sort of spreadsheet-like, was a very good general-purpose format to store the data. You could have indexes on any of those fields so that you could get good performance out of different types of queries. And it also turned out that it's also a very efficient way of storing data, which back in the day when storage was very expensive was also a critical factor. So it's a really good combination of being cost-effective to store data while also giving developers a very generic way of retrieving data and storing data that supported applications, you know, for 20, 30, 40 years now.
And it's made Uncle Larry a lot of money.
It has indeed, yes.
Absolutely. The one thing I do look at this and think is that I look at a document database and think it's almost like a sparse spreadsheet. It's almost like thinking that there might be occasions where there are certain values that are just missing. Like, for instance, for every record I might or might not have a phone number. But in a traditional SQL database, I'd have a field for that and I'd have to put in something that said there was a null value in there. Whereas in a document database, I just don't have that key value pair in the actual object I'm storing in the document.
Exactly. Yeah. The challenge that I think, you know, you mentioned non-relational databases appearing over the last decade or so. I think that's one of the challenges is when you look at the types of data that modern applications are working with, more and more, they don't fit that well into that very rigid tabular format. And there are ways within relational databases like sparse indexes or clobs and things like that, where you can kind of hack it so that it works, for want of a better word. Mm-hmm. But more and more that became a challenge. So that's where you saw all of these different types of databases like key value, document, graph, et cetera, coming along. An example I like to use is an address, right? A very simple concept that you would think would be fairly straightforward to put into a database. But when you think about what address formats look like in the US versus the UK versus Europe, how zip codes or postcodes work in different countries, an address is actually a very different format depending on where you are. And having to force that into a very strict, rigid structure introduces some inefficiencies. It makes queries that much more complex, and it'll work, but it potentially puts a lot of onus on the application developer to handle all of that complexity. Whereas with a document database, that structure is really up to the developer. You can store an address in whatever format that you want. It doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to fit the exact same, you know, half dozen fields. That the different addresses don't have to fit those same criteria, which is something we refer to as polymorphism, where your address will have most of the common elements that mine does, but mine can look different and have different fields, and that's okay. In a relational database, obviously it doesn't.
That's very hard to do, yeah.
Right, and ultimately what that means is that developers have to spend less time worrying about how their data is being stored in the database, and can spend more time building great applications. And, you know, certainly in our case, we've seen huge developer adoption simply because of that reason. It lets developers do what they do best, which is build great code and not have to worry about stopping developing the business logic and worry about how do you take this data object and split it into multiple relational tables. So it's about developer efficiency.
So Martin, from your perspective, you know, do you have a, In your day job, do you have a need to sort of focus on how you're storing certain pieces of data within your environment? You know, whether that's metadata or anything else. I would imagine, you know, you'd have a view on how on earth you would use this in a large organization.
We have probably like a large number of organizations these days. We have a number of document databases, or if you want to call them generic NoSQL databases. And then we also have the more traditional relational databases. So more traditional relational databases are in the transactional systems where we all store customer data, customer records, things which are legacy and well understood. But we do find increasingly with web-related or even media for dealing with metadata, we will find that we will use via document databases more. So I think a lot of times is like many times when people start talking about a new technology, and I hope Dave will agree with me with this, people start thinking about the new technology will supplant the old technology. I think this is a coexistence. Mm-hmm. And we will see this continue for some time, or for ages.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with that. I think we're in a polyglot database world where, you know, developer ultimately has a choice of the type of database that they develop. And I think, you know, for a new application, you know, you have those choices. But I think, you know, to sort of pick up on something you said about supplanting old technologies, not many organizations can go look at applications that they built up over many, many decades and just say, okay, well, we don't need relational databases anymore. Let's throw that all away and rebuild them on some new database. That's just totally impractical. So there's a lot of different options, a lot of different choices, and it gives somebody building an application that choice of using the right data storage for their needs.
And I would also say the other thing about relational databases is actually often it does force you to think a lot more about your data structure and what your data is going to look like. Mm-hmm. Document databases are great, but at times you may find that people don't necessarily have the same level of discipline and understanding of the data which is coming in initially.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. We at MongoDB, we talk about flexibility and, you know, the developer can store data in multiple different ways. Do you embed everything in one document? Do you split it across multiple different documents? There's a lot of choice, but with choice comes responsibility. So the governance of the data is very important, both from the data structure, but also, you know, with things like GDPR and so on, it's very important to be able to have those different governance processes around the database. You're absolutely right. One of the advantages of that very strict, rigid format is that you have to go through a schema design exercise before you build the application and really anytime you're changing anything about the data. And that in and of itself is a good thing. But then having the flexibility that, you know, we had an instance of a customer where they were an auto manufacturer and they'd just come out with a car that was cost $100,000 or more. And it took them, I believe, 18 months to add a single digit to the list price field because of all the governance and procedures that went around and having to change that field in the database to have an extra character, which, you know, when you get to that extreme, that's not necessarily a good thing. So, you know, finding that compromise of the right amount of flexibility and the right amount of choice is definitely important. Data governance is absolutely critical. That doesn't go away just because you're using a different database.
I think there's something else, a term which we need to clarify. We often class these databases as NoSQL databases. Now, I know lots of people get confused with this idea, and I think NoSQL means that you will never use a structured query language to access them. That's not true. NoSQL does not stand for NoSQL. It stands for not only SQL. I think it's very important that people actually remember that, because I've seen people get themselves really confused with this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not only SQL. It's not saying, like you said, throw everything out because we've got something newer that's better. That's not the case. It's, I think that for many years, the question for somebody building an application that needed a database was, what type of relational database would you like to use? Do you want Oracle? Do you want DB2? Do you want SQL Server, Postgres, etc.? You're not forced into that choice anymore. You can make the choice that's appropriate for the application.
I'll add a couple of things onto that I think that are relevant too. And that's, the first one is that in terms of the way that we've developed things over the last, well, say, let's call it 30 years, Dave, since we were looking at IMS at the very beginning in our conversation there. If you look at the way that we've developed in terms of technology, we've got systems that are capable of much more computing power than we ever had. And we've got better, faster storage. We've got, you know, a lot more capability within the way that we write software to create something that needs a bit more horsepower to make it work properly. And I would say that if you look at the way that traditional SQL or relational databases worked, they were very structured and you went through normalization processes and other things in order to try and be as efficient as possible with the technology. We have less need to do that these days. And that's a good thing because it gives the flexibility there. But also, as you said, it can introduce that ability to be occasionally a bit lazy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a combination there of, you know, people, process, technology, as with everything, that, you know, there's still design reviews and so on that need to be applied to your application development process. On the technology side, there's things, in our case, we implement JSON schema, which allows you to define rules around what the data will look like. So again, if it's a customer, it has to have a name, address, and either a phone number or an email, something like that. But then you can add other fields as necessary, or maybe you can't. So you can apply just that right amount of governance as well from a technology point of view, and the database enforces that. But yeah, it's I think it's around really just sort of loosening some of those shackles to enable more productivity, but without just flinging the, you know, the barn doors wide open.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's dive a bit deeper now and think about how some of that stuff might work. Now, we talked initially, and we talked a couple of times about JSON, and we know that there is a number of different markup language formats that we can use for storing documents. And by markup language, we mean something that's more human readable, I guess, is probably a good way to describe that, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, yeah.
I can't remember what JSON actually stands for.
JavaScript Object Notation.
Whoa, look at that. That's a great acronym. That, and it's not like an IBM acronym because it makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's four letters, not three. So.
Yes, true. Yeah, that is a good point. But I think you store within MongoDB as an example. I think you store it within using something called Bison, whatever you
use. Yes, binary, a sense of binary JSON, which I guess should be BJSON, but we abbreviate it. But that's a binary representation of JavaScript object notation. So when you're looking at data in a MongoDB database, you don't know the difference. But the reason we use binary JSON on the disk is that it gives us some efficiencies in terms of reading and writing the data. It also enables us to enforce type fidelity. So when you look at JSON, I think it only has about 6 or 7 different data types,
right,
whereas Bison has about 22. So something like a geospatial coordinate or a date or decimal fields are stored with that appropriate data format, which again means, one, that the developer doesn't have to worry about converting this string they just got into a valid floating point number and doing all of the data checks around that. It also allows us to then map those data types to the equivalent type within a programming language. So you can do a lot of that type enforcement and type fidelity.
Right. Okay. That makes complete sense. And I think if I was an end user, I would actually be seeing something that was more JSON, sort of looked like JSON type code anyway. I wouldn't see that personally. So when, if people are trying to understand what that means, it effectively looks like a piece of XML or a piece of code where you've got column lineups and brackets and you've got fields that are terminated by certain characters. So if anybody's done any sort of markup language or writing of code, it looks quite similar to all of that, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's very similar to XML in terms of the type of structure where you have can nest fields within others, and it's, you know, fields are delimited by certain things. But it's a little more condensed than XML, but very similar in concept and structure.
Yep. Okay. One of the things you talked about earlier, Martin, was the different use of different types of database. And one of the features that seems to me is probably really important is the ability to provide ACID compliance. Now, I'm not sure exactly what that acronym stands for off the top of my head, but obviously that's a good example of something where in a, say, financial environment where you want to commit a transaction and know that that transaction either completes or doesn't, then you would want that feature within the database. I'm fairly sure A is atomic, C is consistent.
That's atomicity.
Consistency.
Consistent. Isolation and durability.
Isolation.
Right, there you go. We got there in the end. I couldn't remember those off the top of my head. And don't go around. I'm not a walking dictionary.
I had to breathe in deeply to remember it.
Yeah.
We got there in the end between us.
But there's no requirement for NoSQL databases to be ACID compliant, even though some of them might be now, because that's just a feature that is either offered or not, I guess.
Yeah, I think originally the NoSQL world was born from needing a way to store data that didn't have the strict requirements of the relational world. And one of those things was, you know, if you're Google, if you're Facebook, if you're an IoT application that's getting millions of sensor readings a second, potentially, you know, that ACID compliance isn't as important. So a lot of those technologies didn't support ACID. However, when you're really starting to target the enterprise world, ACID compliance and strong consistency, which I think we'll get to later, are really table stakes. You know, no one's going to have a banking application written on a platform where my ATM withdrawal might not show up by the time I go into the bank to cash a check, right? So I think having that ACID compliance is very important. So, you know, certainly from the MongoDB perspective, some of the needs actually for ACID in terms of having a transactional structure within the programming language, some of that is rendered moot by the fact that you're denormalizing data. So again, if we go back to that example of a customer object with a relational database, a customer object is probably going to be split into multiple relational tables, right? Maybe a handful once you start getting complex use cases, dozens, maybe even hundreds, thousands, or tens of thousands of tables. And a fairly straightforward update to that object in a relational world will probably hit multiple tables. That's where you need that ACID transaction structure to say, hey, I'm about to do an update. Here's a bunch of updates. Okay, now I'm done with that update. Make sure that all the changes that I made are either all committed or none of them are committed. Right? So that's that start transaction, end transaction type concept. If you've denormalized your data and it's now stored within one JSON object, you can put ACID guarantees around that update, right? So MongoDB has always been ACID compliant at the document level, so that if my name, address, phone numbers, and balance are all stored within one document, you don't have to worry about, you know, only half of the changes being applied. Now, in a distributed database, which most NoSQL databases are, that becomes more complex because you have multiple nodes that potentially are storing the data. And then the question becomes, well, how do I, if I'm making changes to multiple documents that might be spread over multiple nodes, how do I guarantee ACID compliance at that point? So that's a much harder engineering challenge. With MongoDB 4.2, we've been able to now support ACID transaction capability in really any application. But again, because it is a pretty challenging engineering challenge in a distributed system to provide those types of guarantees. So that's why I think some of the other NoSQL technologies don't provide that level of consistency.
I was going to say, we do love our acronyms, don't we? I mean, storage, but DBAs and databases are as bad because you've got ACID, and also you drift into what a CAP theorem as well, mm-hmm. which is consistency, availability, and partition tolerance. It means you can either have consistency or availability in a distributed system. You can't have both.
Or you can have CAP-ELK or something like that. Isn't the one that's a slightly different acronym where you can sort of take a certain degree of, you can sort of offset some of it in one way. I think it's called something like CAP-ELK or PAC-ELK or something like that, which is a variation of it. And then and there's like millions of variations of it. Yeah, it's one of those ones that's so good I can't remember it. But they can't be that good. But you both just touched on something which is really, really important and I think really interesting. And that's this idea of consistency and how that ties to scalability. So if we just look at, say, the cloud world from the last, I don't know, let's call it the last 5 or 10 years, and we've seen the rise of things like S3 and object storage. I think before that, possibly we wouldn't have talked about eventual consistency the way we do today, where we mean, as you said, Dave, that you commit a transaction by, say, doing a write on one particular server and it isn't necessarily distributed to all of the nodes that can potentially provide read access to that data. And sometimes the document might not have shown up elsewhere, and sometimes it might. And that if it's eventually consistent, you have to wait for it to eventually sync up all those different nodes. But that's a scalability issue, isn't it, really, to allow you to scale compared to what you'd have to do with a traditional monolithic relational database.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's complexity that's introduced by having multiple nodes. And you're right, you can, eventual consistency gives you the ability to apply updates to any one of those nodes at any point in time. But it brings with it the challenge of basically, what if you change the same record as I do at the same time? Who wins, right? And if you and I have both had those changes committed and our applications both think that that change has been applied, what happens when one of them is backed out? Right. So there's application level, two-phase commit type structures that you can use to work around that. But that does introduce challenges. Now, in some use cases, that doesn't matter. The IoT use case, if you're streaming data from a sensor and maybe you lose a couple of data points, is that the end of the world? Well, no, it isn't. But again, with the sort of the banking application, strong consistency is pretty much table stakes. So the way we've approached that is, MongoDB can be strongly consistent by default, but there are tuning parameters that an application developer can use to say, for instance, if you're applying a change to a cluster that has three nodes in it, do you want to wait for all three nodes to confirm the change, which is the ultimate strong consistency, but has latency implications? Or do you only want to allow it to apply to one of those nodes and continue, at which point there may be a chance of some data loss? If that node goes down before it's replicated? Or do you want to wait for, let's say, a majority of those nodes to commit the change, at which point you're pretty much guaranteed to not lose that change, even if you lose a node? So we approach it from the point of view of you need to provide strong consistency. That's sort of a standard in enterprise-grade applications, but also provide that tunability and that flexibility for the developer to make sure that their queries can match the latency that they need.
Yeah. So, Martin, in terms of the storage industry, we've seen many solutions where we would want strong consistency and other ones where maybe we're starting to get used to the idea of eventual consistency. And I mentioned S3, but, that's pretty much a standard tenet for the storage industry itself, isn't it?
I guess so. It's one of those things which is quite hard to get your head around, this idea that you may not access something which is the latest instantiation of that for whatever reason, whether it matters to you or not. It is a bit of a paradigm shift for a lot of people.
I agree. I think it entirely is. But there are good reasons why you might say that that's perfectly acceptable. If you've done updates to a document where it doesn't really matter if you haven't got the most accurate version because you've been tweaking something in a piece of audio, and then you want to push that audio out to everybody across the CDN network, it doesn't necessarily matter if it's not entirely the most efficient version of that one. So there are scenarios where you can see it's perfectly reasonable to distribute data in that fashion. And I guess we're using it as a compromise when we're trying to bring data back in. So if we've got data at the edge and we want to bring that data back in, we're accepting that eventual consistency will eventually show those records up in the core from where we do something with them. So I suppose if you think of it in those terms, it's possibly, you know, you can get your head around it a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's just understanding how, if you have conflicting updates, the resolution to it. And I think that's absolutely key to developers and everybody to understand, how does it get resolved and what are your risks that you may lose something which you didn't want to lose?
Yeah, good point. Good point.
Right, exactly.
Good point. Okay, let's talk about probably one thing that to me sort of leaps out is probably one of the most challenging things then with all of this is, how on earth do you do indexing and searching across a set of records that doesn't actually look consistent, where some key values might be in some records, some objects, and some might not be in others? It seems to me that that's quite a difficult challenge to achieve, Dave.
It is, but it's also a critical one to solve, because the reason relational databases have been so popular is, again, that the general purpose ability to, hey, I've got a new use case, I access my data slightly differently, but I don't want to be doing table scans the whole time. I have to be able to index through a certain field. So that requirement was basically, again, table stakes from the beginning. The good thing is with a JSON structure, each document may look different. It may not be identical. There may be different fields, different structures. There may be a geospatial data in a particular field. There may be strings, dates, floating point numbers, etc. But each field does have a name, essentially. So in the same way in a relational world where each row in the database has specific columns identified within it, in a JSON document, each field has a name, right? So that's your way to then define an index on that field. So, you know, in the US, we have states, right? So you can define an index on state or on zip code. In the UK, there's a postcode. So you can define an index on postcode, right? So there is that thing that you can apply an index to. Now, building and maintaining that index is much more complex in that world than it is in the standardized format of a relational world. But it is a problem that's solvable. That's how we work through that.
And the most obvious one to me is, if you've got an index that's based on a field that's sparsely populated and you add a load more records in there and they're not already there, you're continually updating those indexes to say that that record now has that in, and rather than not having it in. I can see why it could be very challenging to keep on top of.
Yes. And it is, you know, part of that schema design. You know, a lot of times people talk about document databases being schemaless. We try and modify that terminology to be a flexible schema, because there is still a schema. Your data still has some sort of structure, and it's important, again, going back to the governance type question, to at least have that schema design process. And the index definition is important, because if you don't have the right indexes, that's going to cause issues. But if you have too many indexes, that can cause issues as well, because, like you said, you're constantly rebuilding indexes that maybe you don't really need. So it is a important part of the application design process.
Design, yeah. What about storage engines then? So typically, I mean, we talk about storage all the time, but obviously somehow you've got to store this data on disk somehow. And there must be some sort of feature of the database that's doing that. And that's what a storage engine does. So how are they different in Mongo? And how's that evolved over the years? Because I think there's been more than one, hasn't there?
Yeah, that's a really great point, very important to talk about. So the original MongoDB storage engine was Mmap, which was part of the product from the beginning. One of the challenges that we found with that was the way it handled locking of documents on disk. So sometimes people will say, you know, MongoDB is great for reading data, but it performs poorly in writing data. And that came from the way Mmap worked with documents on disk. So we realized very early on that that was going to be a challenge as we grew and essentially started to go after true enterprise workloads. So we acquired a company called Wired Tiger, which completely changed the game for all of those sort of performance characteristics. You know, I always say, if you think about what a database does, it stores data on disk. So the storage engine that handles that interaction with the disk is a pretty important part. So WireTiger is really what changed the game for us there. And those sort of write throughput concerns went away as of version 3.0 when WireTiger became one of the storage engines. Mm-hmm. And that really set us on the path towards a lot of the advanced features you see now, like, for instance, ACID transactions. We did architect the product so that you can have pluggable storage engines, so you can use different storage engines with Mongo. We have an in-memory storage engine that gives you the ability to store the entire database in memory, but Wired Tiger is the default now.
And as you said, that's really, I mean, it's super important. It's it's something that exists in SQL databases and relational databases already. And I guess it sometimes can be difficult to understand why that's relevant. But, you know, common sense tells you, as we all know, about different media types. And as you said, with putting things in memory, a storage engine needs to have an understanding of the underlying media, because it might be able to get better benefit out of it using it a certain way, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, it's the same challenges that relational databases have solved over the years with, you know, the working set in memory, where the most commonly accessed data is stored in memory, because it's quicker to read it from memory than reading from a disk. So it's the same challenge. And that's something that Wired Tiger brought for us, is a lot of advanced capabilities in that area. Obviously different challenges because the data structures are different, but it's really ultimately the same issue, is you want to be making sure that the data that you're accessing is in memory where possible. And certainly for an index, you need the index in memory as well, so that you're not going to disk to read an index before you even read the data. That can have major latency issues. So it really is very, very important to have the right storage engine defined.
Underneath that. Mm-hmm. But do you see any challenges there, Martin, with the way that you roll out your database environments and so on, in terms of looking at the physical storage? You know, do you still see that same conversation with people saying, oh, you need to put the indexes on RAID 1 and you need to put the data on RAID 5, as we used to have in the old days with the DBAs? Or do you still have that discussion with them today?
We still have that discussion with them today. There's a whole load of myths which are still perpetuated. Every now and then you come across documents. Oracle documents best practice seems to be best practice and has been best practice forever and doesn't seem to change. But I do know things like Wired Tiger, for instance, prefers to be running on Flash, doesn't want to be running on spinning Rust. It is much better on Flash, like almost everything is, but it is much, much more suited to that. And I believe there's a preference often to have non-SAN attached disk and have it local Flash as well.
Okay, so yeah, and you know, still as important as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely. Very much so.
Definitely. Okay, let's just touch on one little thing, and then we can go on and talk about some of the use cases, Dave, just to see if you can give us some good examples. But first of all, one thing that I think, for me, I think is really important is understanding how we interact with a NoSQL database. Because clearly, we know SQL is called SQL because it uses a query language. So, and obviously, with a lot of the programming environments, there are tools and plugins, especially with things like .NET, to allow you to manage the way that you program the database and visualize it while you're developing your code. How does that work with the NoSQL environments and in terms of query and how you build that query up? And are there any tools out there that plug in a similar way to the things like the .NET environments?
That's a great question. And when you're choosing a database, it's definitely really critical to understand not just how the data is stored and how does that align to your use case, but how are your developers going to interact with the database and what sort of skill sets do they have? The short answer really is that each database provides its own query language. So Couchbase has something like Nickel, N1QL, MarkLogic uses XQuery, Cassandra has SQL, MongoDB uses MQL, MongoDB query language. So each one will have its own language that aligns closely to how it stores that data and how it enables you to query it. So there's definitely a learning curve there. I think, you know, each organization needs to look at, you know, what their skill sets in-house are as far as how big that learning curve is. I know we often find that with MQL, it's fairly straightforward to pick up. Again, going back to that sort of object-oriented programming language concept, the drivers we provide with MongoDB essentially make MongoDB almost an extension of that programming language. So it's very easy for the developer to pick up and work with that programming language and query language in building their queries and updates.
Right.
In terms of a SQL view, some tools, some databases will provide a way to essentially translate SQL into the native database. At Mongo, we have something called the BI connector, the Business Intelligence Connector, that's aimed at, you know, those analytical tools like Qlik and Tableau and so on that really only speak SQL. And that will do a on-the-fly dynamic translation of SQL into MongoDB. Mm-hmm. It's not for building applications. I want to stress that. It's really just to provide that sort of generic connector because it's so prevalent in the industry. Yeah. So there's a few instances of things like that that allow you to apply SQL to a non-SQL database.
Okay, all right. So let's talk about some use cases then, Dave. We talked about one at the very beginning there that you highlighted, you know, the idea of maybe edge or IoT. You know, what sort of things are you seeing people do in terms of moving their business on from traditional databases and trying to use this sort of new technology?
There's a few categories that really we see coming up over and over again. One very common one is something we call single view. So there's an example out there. You can Google it. There's a bunch of public articles on it where MetLife were looking to build a single view as an application called The Wall, where basically if you're a customer, you contact a customer service agent, and what they wanted to provide was that agent with an aggregated view of all the different policies that that customer might have. And all of them were stored in individual separate applications, separate databases, probably built on different relational technologies in different decades. And aggregating all of that data together is really powerful for that sort of customer service agent type use case. But also, once you've aggregated that data, it really unlocks a lot of analytical and insight use cases. So that's a very common one that we see in a lot of different industries. I think the IoT use case is also very common. You do see a lot of key value databases used in an IoT scenario because they're very efficient at writing. And basically, you know, you have maybe a timestamp and a device ID as the key and the values from the sensors as the value, which is very good at writing. But what we're seeing is, you know, one of my coworkers has a great saying, you know, the business value of writing something to a database is zero. The business value comes from when you read that data back and do something intelligent with it. So by providing a more structured way to persist that data and maybe bucketing data over a time series, pre-aggregating data, that's where a document structure gives you those capabilities. Mm-hmm. So that would be a common use case as well.
Martin, you've already touched on it, the fact that from your perspective, there are some examples where you can use a traditional database and other times when you can use something like a MongoDB or a NoSQL type solution. Do you think we're going to see more and more of that in the environment as people actually start thinking, do you know, where can I start to rationalize my applications as I rewrite them and so on?
Yeah, but we are making some assumptions here, Chris, that people rewrite applications. I think the evidence suggests that very few people rewrite very many applications. Yeah, I think we shall see it. And this whole area of NoSQL and document databases are interesting. The agility a document database brings is the most interesting thing. Just the ability to add extra fields in without actually realizing or not having to go back and add extra fields to every table in a traditional database. So it's his ability to rapidly change and to rapidly develop things. Well, because we're seeing this happen so often, we're seeing applications changing so quickly, new applications, legacy applications still move at glacial-like speeds. But this iterative development process means that we will see more and more document and key value store databases just becoming, they will become the default for most things, but there'll still be a huge amount of legacy tail around the place.
So Dave, that was great. I think that was a really interesting introduction to the idea of using a different database type. It was great to get into some of the detail of the technology, but also as Martin just finished off with talking about, you know, why it's going to be useful in the future. So if people want to find out more and maybe stalk you online and find you on social media, where can they go? If not, and they want to go corporate, where should we point them to in terms of MongoDB?
Yeah, absolutely. So mongodb.com, a lot of great customer stories. We're an open source product, so you can download the product and try it out yourself. We've got a MongoDB as a service atlas that's free to try as well if you want to play around with the technology. As far as me, I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter. Twitter is Kopi David, and LinkedIn is David Kopi, K-O-P-P-E. And you can put links into that in the podcast.
Okay. Well, Dave, thanks for joining us. It's been really interesting. Look forward to catching up soon.
Yeah, great catching up. Nice meeting you, Madhu.
Cheers.
Nice meeting you.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.